Okay, so we'll start with a quote today, and this is from Bhante's memoirs, one of the volumes of Bhante's memoirs, The Rainbow Road. And it finds him staying in a cave at the ashram, or just above the ashram of Ramana Maharshi. And it's probably about 1949, late 1940s. So here we go. One night, I found myself, as it were, out of the body, and in the presence of Amitabha, the Buddha of infinite light, who presides over the western quarter of the universe. The colour of the Buddha was a deep, rich, luminous red, like that of rubies, though at the same time soft and glowing, like the light of the setting sun. While his left hand rested on his lap, the fingers of his right hand held up by the stalk a single red lotus in full bloom, and he sat in the usual cross-legged posture on an enormous red lotus that floated on the surface of the sea. To the left, immediately beneath the raised right arm of the Buddha, was the red hemisphere of the setting sun, its reflection glittering golden across the waters. How long the experience lasted, I do not know, for I seemed to be out of time as well as out of the body. But I saw the Buddha as clearly as I had ever seen anything under the ordinary circumstances of my life. Indeed, far more clearly and vividly. The rich red colour of Amitabha himself, as well as of the two lotuses and the setting sun, made a particularly deep impression on me. It was more wonderful, more appealing than any earthly red. It was like red light, but so soft and at the same time so vivid as to be altogether without parallel. In the course of the next few days, I composed a series of stanzas describing the vision. Contrary to my usual practice, I failed to write them down afterwards, with the result that they gradually faded from my mind. But the experience itself never faded. Nearly a quarter of a century later, the figure of the Red Buddha is as clear to me in recollection as it was the next morning in the Virupaksha Guha. So, in yesterday's talk, we were exploring the vertical dimension of spiritual friendship. And I finished the talk with reference to beauty and a hierarchy of beauty, and said how our vertical Kalyana Mitras can reveal to us higher degrees of beauty than we're accustomed to, that they can reveal that to us. And here I'm starting with this quote to connect with that previous point of the final point of the previous talk. Here we've got a beautiful form. The way Bhante describes it is particularly vivid to us, isn't it? But a beautiful form appearing to Bhante in the depths of his meditation. And also in the quote, we hear at the end that where Bhante is staying is the Virupaksha Guha. Guha is the Pali for the word guhya in Sanskrit. And we've heard that word several times already in the previous couple of days, haven't we? So guhya, meaning secret or hidden. And I've said that spiritual friendship by its nature is guhya. It's a matter of experience, it's something we can talk about, but ultimately it's something we've got to do. It's something that we've got to experience. It's guhya in nature. Guhya literally means cave. I think I said that on the first day, didn't I? So that's how it's being used here. The Virupaksha Guha is the Virupaksha cave. But we've also heard the word guhya in reference to the three esoteric refuges, which I introduced yesterday, the three tantric, the three guhya refuges of the guru, the yidam, and the dakini. And I suggested yesterday that those three esoteric refuges are a way into talking about different dimensions of spiritual friendship. So yesterday we looked at we drew inspiration from the esoteric refuge of the guru to look at the vertical dimension of spiritual friendship. And today we're looking at the guhya refuge of the yidam, And the dimension of spiritual friendship that I'm going to talk about this morning is the imaginal dimension of spiritual friendship. So a few words to begin with about the Yidam. So the Yidam is the esoteric Dharma refuge. And it's the esoteric Dharma refuge because it's what one actually practices. So this is coming out of the Vajrayana tradition, don't forget. So what is actually practiced, what is alive, what embodies the Dharma for the Vajrayana practitioner, the tantric practitioner, is the Buddha or Bodhisattva that they've been given in the course of initiation by the Guru to meditate upon. That is one's Yidam. So whether it's Amitabha, whether it's Green Tara, whether it's Vajrasattva, that Buddha or Bodhisattva is one's Yidam. And the word Yidam is a Tibetan word, means something like oath-bound or bound by oath. The bond, the oath, is the samaya that one takes at the time of initiation with that particular Buddha or Bodhisattva. So you make the pledge to turn up every day. You will turn up, you will visualize them, you will chant their mantra, you will put yourself in their presence, and they will turn up every day. In fact, they're there all the time, but you will come into communication with them every day. That's the oath, that's the bond that you've got. And the Yidam embodies the particular aspect of the Dharma, the aspect of reality that you will meditate upon and that will become a doorway for the practitioner into enlightenment itself. So obviously this is not a concept, it's not an idea, it's an image, it's something concrete. If you like, it's a person or an absolute person. So you're meditating on the qualities embodied in a kind of human form, albeit on an archetypal kind of level. And in the course of doing that every day, meditating on this particular Buddha or Bodhisattva and their qualities, or the qualities that they represent, one absorbs those qualities. One begins to develop those qualities oneself. So if you're meditating every day on the Buddha Amitabha and infinite love, well, you're cultivating those qualities of infinite love. If you meditate every day on Vajrasattva and the primordial purity that Vajrasattva embodies, you're cultivating that within your own experience. So there's a similarity with what we saw yesterday in relation to the Guru, that the vertical Kalyana Mitras that we have stand, as it were, on a higher level, and in communication with them, through contact with them, our level of consciousness is raised up to their level of consciousness. So it's the same with the Yidam. Albeit the Yidam is free of all limitations in terms of time and in terms of space. They're embodiments of universal qualities, and we're being raised up to higher and higher levels of being able to manifest and embody that quality ourselves. And in the order, of course, we're not a Vajrayana order, we're not a tantric movement, but we have our equivalent of this ourselves, don't we? So at the time of ordination, order members receive a sadhana, the practice of visualization and mantra recitation on a particular Buddha or Bodhisattva. And when you guys are ordained, you will take on a particular sadhana, you'll meditate on a particular Buddha or Bodhisattva, be developing their qualities. They will be the doorway for you into the depths of reality itself. So the Guhya refuge of the Yidam raises the whole area of imagination. And as I've said, we're going to explore this in this talk, the imaginal dimension of spiritual friendship. So it's important to acknowledge that when Bhante talks about imagination, he is using that term in a specific kind of way. Often when we hear the word used, imagination, it's to do with fantasy or making something up that's not real. Often when we hear imagination, that's what's been suggested. Bhante doesn't use the term in that kind of way. So he makes a distinction between imagination and fantasy. So fantasy is something that is just purely fictitious and self-referential. So sexual fantasy being the classic example of that. It's something made up. It's something about us. It's always coming back to us and referring back to ourselves. The imagination, in the way Bhante uses the term, it's a liberating faculty. It's a higher faculty than the ordinary mind. So one definition of imagination would be that it unites our reason and our emotions and transcends them in a higher faculty, the faculty of imagination. Actually, to call it a faculty is to do a disservice to the imagination. We can only call it a faculty because it's so underdeveloped in us that it feels like one piece among many. But ultimately, we are imagination. We're imagining all the time. Our whole of our experience is, in a sense, imaginal. It's just a case of whether we use the imagination skillfully to liberate us, or misuse or even abuse that faculty to keep ourselves more and more locked into samsara and a way of seeing that just keeps us locked into suffering. So we are imaginal beings, so to speak. So one of the lectures Bhante has given in the past that I think is really helpful in relation to imagination is history versus myth in mankind's quest for meaning. History versus myth in, I think it's in humanity's quest for meaning, beg your pardon. And that's in the Vimalakirti Nadesha series that he gave, I think, in the late 70s. Anybody correct me on that? Late 70s, early 80s, 1980, there or thereabouts. So history versus myth in humanity's quest for meaning. And the starting point Bhante has in that lecture is to describe a mural painting, a Chinese mural painting, in which Vimalakirti, the bodhisattva who's manifesting as a sick layperson, is confronting Manjushri. And he says in the lecture that Vimalakirti represents history, represents time. So Vimalakirti is a particular personality. He's got this particular name, lives in a particular city, I think it's Vaishali. He's manifesting as a merchant, so he has a particular occupation, has a family. So he represents time or history. Manjushri, by contrast, he doesn't have any of that. So Manjushri is eternally youthful, eternally appearing as a 16-year-old prince, not bound by time and space in any way, can manifest in time and space, but not in any way bound by them. So he's an embodiment of archetypal qualities. So Manjushri then represents myth. So you've got history versus myth coming into conflict. And Bhante makes the point that we often feel bound by our historical reality, if you like. We feel bound by time and space. We feel the oppression of existing within time and space. You know, the fact that we have got this particular name, this particular job, we do these particular things, we can feel that as an oppression. And he says one of the reasons why something like Lord of the Rings, he's giving this example at a particular time, Lord of the Rings is so fascinating to people, or science fiction, fantasy novels are so fascinating to people, is that they liberate us from that sense of being bound only by time and space. So we connect with archetypes. You know, we connect with the archetypes of the wizard or the hero in a particular story. And that demonstrates that on another level, we are archetypal beings. We can inhabit archetypal realms in our imagination and the use of our imagination. We can liberate ourselves from time and space. But this is the really important point. He says we can't opt for myth and discard history. Just because we've got that capacity and we can go into these archetypal realms, we can't leave behind the historical reality. And in fact, it's not literally that there's history and myth as two different dimensions or realms that exist side by side and we travel from one and back into the other. It's not really like that. It might appear like that, but it's not really like that. And ultimately, what we have to realize is that history is myth, and myth is history. So Vimalakirti is Manjushri, and Manjushri is Vimalakirti. Time is eternity, eternity is time. And then he even goes as far as to say Rupa is Shunyata, Shunyata is Rupa. So deep stuff. But showing us that we have this imaginal faculty, we have this imaginal power, we can liberate, but we exist in the realm, or it appears that we exist in the realms of history and myth simultaneously. So we can't ever leave history behind completely. So often in discussions about imagination, the emphasis is on liberating oneself from history, liberating ourselves from the historical, from time and space, opening up to the archetypal. And that's great, that's a good emphasis to have, that's what we need to cultivate our capacity, our ability to do. But today I want to talk about the use of imagination in relation to history, in relation to the historical dimension of experience, to put it like that. So this means the use of our imagination in relation to other people. So how do we use the imagination creatively in relation to other people, particularly in relation to our friends, in relation to our spiritual friends? And to do this, we have to consider the link between the imagination and ethics. So the link between imagination and our ethical lives, our ethical practice. So a quotation here from Sangharakshita in Seminar. So this is a seminar on the 10 pillars of Buddhism given on the ordination course in Tuscany in 1984, which I believe was Satyaraja's ordination course, who's with us this morning. So Bhante says in the seminar, through your imagination, say if you read a history book, you can project yourself way beyond the 20th century, back into the 15th century, back into the 5th century BC, and so on. You emancipate yourself from the order of space and time. This is all through the use of your imagination. So this is the key bit. In the same way, you can emancipate yourself from your own bodily experience. Project yourself into the bodily experience of some other person. In the same way, through your imagination, emancipate yourself from the present. Project yourself into the future and foresee what will be the consequences of your present action. All these things involve use of one's imagination. In some ways, it's as simple as that. So there's this connection between these two points. In both cases, one needs to use one's imagination more, both in empathizing with the other person and envisaging possible consequences of one's own actions. So two ways then in which we can use our imagination in relation to our ethical lives, in relation to other people as well. So one is, as Bhante says, projecting ourselves imaginatively into the bodily experience of another person. If you like, seeing life from their perspective, being in their shoes, so to speak. The other is to be able to project ourselves through time, so imagining the future, and through doing that, being able to predict as much as one possibly can the consequences of one's actions. So it's obvious, isn't it? It's absolutely crucial to our ethical practice that we can do those two things, that we can try to predict the consequences of actions, and that we can also really empathize, really love other people through imagining life from their perspective. So in the Ten Pillars of Buddhism itself, that was the seminar on the Ten Pillars, Bhante really emphasizes again the importance of the imagination, particularly with regard to the first precept. So he quotes Shelley, the Romantic poet, who says that the great secret of morals is love, or a going out of our own nature and an identification of ourselves with the beautiful which exists in thought, action, or person, not our own. A man to be greatly good must imagine intensely and comprehensively. He must put himself in the place of another and of many others. The pains and pleasures of his species must become his own. So a man to be greatly good must imagine intensively and comprehensively and put himself in the place of another and of many others. So using the imagination to really connect, empathize, and imagine life from another person's perspective. He then goes on to quote from the Bodhicaryavatara, Shantideva, and the quote here is, "We love our hands and other limbs as members of the body, then why not love other living beings as members of the universe? By constant use, man comes to imagine that his body, which has no self-being, is a self. Why then should he not conceive his self to lie in his fellows also?" So again, using the imagination, which we're doing all the time, the limbs of our body create a whole piece, a single body. What about all the people in the universe creating one universe? So using one's imagination to identify. And in terms of the Buddhist scriptures, perhaps this finds the most beautiful expression in the Vimalakirti Nidesha. We've already heard from the History Versus Myth lecture about that confrontation between Vimalakirti and Manjushri. Vimalakirti has been visited by Manjushri because the Buddha has heard that he's sick. He's manifesting as a sick layman. And I won't go into the story, but Manjushri is the only bodhisattva that's willing to go and visit Vimalakirti. And he does, and he inquires as to the nature of Vimalakirti's illness. And Vimalakirti's reply is this: "Manjushri, my sickness comes from ignorance and the thirst for existence, and it will last as long as do the sicknesses of all living beings. Were all living beings to be free from sickness, I also would not be sick. Why? Manjushri, for the Bodhisattva, the world consists only of living beings, and sickness is inherent in living in the world. Were all living beings free of sickness, the Bodhisattva also would be free of sickness. For example, Manjushri, when the only son of a merchant is sick, both his parents become sick on account of the sickness of their son, and the parents will suffer as long as that only son does not recover from his sickness. Just so, Manjushri, the Bodhisattva loves all living beings as if each were his only child. He becomes sick when they are sick and is cured when they are cured. You ask me, Manjushri, whence comes my sickness? The sicknesses of the Bodhisattvas arise from great compassion." So the Bodhisattva then is able to imaginatively identify not just with one or two living beings, but with all living beings, and connects with them on the basis of their existential situation. So as he says, it's coming, a sickness is coming from ignorance and the thirst for existence. As long as that exists in the world, it's not about him, as long as it exists anywhere in the world, in any person, then he too will feel that. He too will empathize with that. He too will respond to that. So we've got here a supreme example of imaginative identification, imaginative empathy. So just in case we're inclined to dismiss that as kind of Mahayana hyperbole and going a bit too far, there are precedents for that, of course, and a precedent in the Pali Canon itself. Finding that we're turning to the Pali Canon a lot in these talks. But we've got a precedent for this in the case of dysentery in the Vinaya Pitaka, where we hear in that particular episode that there's a sick monk, a monk with dysentery, and the other monks have left him to his own devices, actually left him on the floor in his hut, laying in his own excrement. And the Buddha and Ananda, as they were inclined to do by the sounds of it, were doing the rounds, visiting the different huts, and they come across the sick monk. And the Buddha asks the monk who's sick what's wrong with him. So he tells them he's sick, he's got dysentery. And he said, well, why have the other monks left you in this state? And the sick monk said, because I'm useless to them. I'm useless to them. This is after, by the way, the Buddha has himself immediately responded to the situation, asked Ananda to go and fetch water, and the two of them together have cleaned the monk and helped him and cared for him. But anyway, the other monks have left him because he's useless. So the Buddha wants to find out what's happening. He goes and gathers the other monks together. He asks them, is there a monk who is sick? They say, yes, Lord. Is he suffering with dysentery? Yes, Lord. Well, why have you left him? Why have you left him like that? And they say, because he's useless to us. Because he's useless to us. So Bhante's commentary on this particular sutta is very interesting, very insightful. And on that particular point, this declaration, this confession, I suppose, on the part of the other monks, that they've left their brother because he's sick, Bhante says, the words imply, sadly, that people are interested in you only so long as you are useful to them. Only so long as they can get something out of you. It implies that they see you not as a person, but as a thing. So people are interested in you only so long as you're useful to them. They see you as a person, not as a person, but as a thing. And he goes on to say, this is in the lecture on the case of dysentery, to treat a person as a thing is to treat them unethically. And this apparently is how the other monks were treating the sick monk. He was not useful to them, and so they were not interested in him. And then he brings it closer to home. Only too often we ourselves can behave like this. We often consider people primarily in terms of their usefulness. We do this even within the spiritual community. Sometimes we are more interested in someone's talents and capacities as a bricklayer, accountant, or lecturer than in what they are in themselves. If you are treated in this way, then, when you are no longer able or willing to employ your talents, you may have the disappointing and disillusioning experience of finding that nobody wants to know you. Nobody wants to be friends with you anymore. We must therefore learn to see persons as persons. There must be kindness between us, there must be spiritual friendship, as there was between the Buddha and Ananda. There must be sympathy, sensitivity, and awareness. So quite hard-hitting, but pointing out to us that the problem often that we have is that we see people as things rather than seeing people as people. It's a lack of imagination, to use that language, or a misuse of the imagination, perhaps. We don't see people as they are, we see people as things and as we want to see them. That's what happens, that's what goes on, as Bhante says, even within the spiritual community. It's human nature, it's unenlightened human nature, so we don't have to feel too bad about it or too guilty about that. But we do have to take responsibility for that innate way of seeing and relating to other people, and of course go beyond it. So the link here between imagination, empathy, and the problem of seeing people as things rather than as people, the link between that and spiritual friendship should be really clear, that creeps into our spiritual friendships as well. So what can we do about it? That's the question, isn't it? What can we do about that? How do we cultivate the imaginal dimension in our spiritual friendships. So another quote from Bhante, lots of quotes today. This is from Pieces of Fire, his collection of aphorisms. The quote actually comes from the seminar on Dhyana for Beginners. He says, only individuals can practice true friendliness. Only individuals can practice true friendliness. So we could slightly alter that. Only individuals can be true spiritual friends. So only individuals can be true spiritual friends. So we've almost got a paradox there, haven't we? To be a true spiritual friend to somebody, we have to be an individual. We have to be able to stand on our own two feet and be an individual in order to connect with another person who can also be an individual in a bond of spiritual friendship. The spiritual friendship is the bond between those two individuals who are developing more and more their individuality. So Bhante said a lot about individuality, about the true individual, the nature of the true individual. There's a whole collection of talks and writings on that theme collected together in what is the Sangha. So that's the place to go if you want to do a bit more background reading on what Bhante's had to say about the true individual. There's no definitive list of the qualities of the true individual. I spent several occasions trying to find the list of qualities of the true individual, and it doesn't actually exist. There are various lists, various qualities that are drawn up. So you get things like the true individual is aware, the true individual is emotionally positive, the true individual has broken free of group conditioning, etc., etc., etc. In a lecture in 1982 on fidelity, Bhante talks about the qualities of the true individual, and he makes the point that the list keeps growing. So I was quite relieved when I read that okay, there's no definitive list. And maybe that says something about the nature of the true individual as well. There's just an abundance of qualities. Always we could discover more and more qualities of the true individual. But in that lecture, in the 1982 lecture, Fidelity, Bhante adds the quality of fidelity to the list of qualities of the true individual. So fidelity is a quality of the true individual, and in that sense it's a quality of spiritual friendship. And I'd like to, for the rest of the talk, just explore some of the themes from that lecture on fidelity. It gives us, I think, some helpful pointers, particularly in relation to what it is that prevents us from imaginatively identifying and empathizing with our spiritual friends. And that's what we really need to understand, isn't it? We need to understand, well, what are the obstacles? What are the things that prevent us from really seeing people as people and slipping into the habit of seeing them as things? So we'll look at that for the rest of the talk, particularly what the obstacles are. We'll start to open up, well, how do we get beyond those obstacles? And then in tomorrow's talk, we'll take that further and really look at how we connect and relate imaginatively to our spiritual friends on deeper and deeper levels. Okay, so the lecture on fidelity. Bhante, as he often does, goes to the dictionary and gives us a dictionary definition of what fidelity is. So it is faithfulness, it's loyalty. But as he himself says, that doesn't really tell us very much about what fidelity is. To really get a feel for what fidelity is, we have to look at the objects of fidelity, what we have fidelity towards or for. So three objects of fidelity. Fidelity to oneself, which we could relate to in terms of integrity, integration. Do we stay faithful and loyal to ourselves and what we stand for, what we are true to. Secondly, there's fidelity to one's ideals. So what we integrate around, do we have fidelity towards those ideals? So oneself, one's ideals. And thirdly, and of particular interest to us on this retreat and our theme of spiritual friendship, fidelity towards other people, or faithfulness, loyalty towards other people. So maybe that gives us more of a sense of what this particular quality is, what it's getting at. And to practice fidelity really does require imagination in the ways that we've been exploring it already today. And that's because one of the qualities of the individual, to go back to our list of qualities of the individual, even the essence of individuality, Bhante describes it in this lecture, the essence of individuality is self-reflective awareness. It's the capacity to be able to stand back and observe oneself, observe others. So an awareness of self and others as existing through time. So the essence of individuality, we could say, is the awareness of self and others as existing through time. So without that, it's impossible to have fidelity. It's impossible to be loyal to another person. It's impossible to be a spiritual friend without that awareness of self and other existing through time. So why is that the case? Well, if you can't see that your friend has a past, a present, and a future, you can't see your friend as a continuity. Yeah, you can't see your friend as a continuity. You can't relate to them in terms of going for refuge. If you can't see that your friend has a past, present, and future, you can't relate to them in terms of going for refuge, because that implies, as we saw on the first day, a process, a movement in somebody's being, a going for refuge. It's not a standing still. So if we don't see somebody as existing through time, we can't relate to them in terms of going for refuge. And that is the essence of spiritual friendship, as we've seen on previous days. If there's no going for refuge involved, then it can't be a spiritual friendship. So we can't relate to our spiritual friends if we don't have that sense of them existing through time. We can't relate to them as the Buddha related to other people, as the Buddha related to people as people, which again, as we saw previously, the Buddha's vision of human beings was of a lake of lotuses in different stages of development. So some in the mud, some pushing up, some coming out, but growing, living, evolving. That's how the Buddha related to people, saw their potentiality, saw it flowering, saw it moving through time, as it were. So it's the mutual recognition of that in each other, as each other is growing, thriving, evolving beings through time, through space. It's that mutual acknowledgement in each other that is the basis of and what defines a spiritual friendship. So what we really need to do then is to develop a sense of that, develop the imaginative capacity to see others in terms of their growth in time. If we do that, then we can be a spiritual friend to people more and more effectively. Just to say, I'm sure we're doing it already, by the way. I'm not implying that this is completely alien to us. It's just a case of becoming more aware of it so that we can become more and more effective at it. But what is it that's getting in the way then? Let's really see if we can pin down what obstructs us seeing people in this kind of way and relating to others, relating to our spiritual friends in this kind of way. Well, Bhante, in the lecture on fidelity, he picks out two obstacles to fidelity. We can broaden that out and say two obstacles to spiritual friendship. So I'm going to name what those two obstacles are. But I'll offer my own commentary on them and relate that to spiritual friendship. So you won't find everything I'm about to say in the lecture. So there's a near enemy and there's a far enemy. The far enemy of fidelity, or far enemy of spiritual friendship and seeing people as people, if you like, the far enemy is distraction. The far enemy is distraction. So we simply forget about our spiritual friends. One of the reasons we don't relate to them as people is because we forget about them. So we forget about people because we get distracted from them. Other things get in the way. So things come into the present moment that mean that our sense of a continuity in our relationship with our spiritual friend gets breached or gets broken. So a few examples. We forget that it's our friend's birthday and we don't send them a card. We forget that on Friday our spiritual friend is returning from retreat and we don't send them a message to say, welcome back, hope you had a good retreat, let's catch up soon. We just forget those things. It might be that we forget things that our spiritual friend has told us that were really important to them. Whether it's sharing memories, whether it's sharing what's going on for them, whether it's sharing sources of inspiration. It might be that we're aware of them when they're telling us, but at a later point we just forget it. We get distracted from that by whatever we do after we've met them, and we just forget. It might be that as they're actually telling us, we're distracted and we don't hear it and we don't take it in. So distraction then is something that undermines our capacity to be a real spiritual friend to other people. So if that's the case, we've got to be really careful with inputs, haven't we? One of Bhante's 15 points for order members was reduce inputs. I think that applies to all of us, particularly in modern Western life. The inputs are everywhere, aren't they? The stimulation is everywhere. So we've got to be really careful what we're putting in, what we're allowing into our minds, and try to cultivate a less distracted mind. So you don't often hear that point made, I don't think, you know, in the whole discourse about mindfulness and distraction, the mindfulness versus distraction. Usually it's about being a bit happier. So it's good to be less distracted and feel more together and feel more mindful, because then you'll be more happy. But what about that in relation to spiritual friendship? It's good to be less distracted. It's good to cultivate more mindfulness so that you can love another person more fully and wholeheartedly and really take them in and really be a spiritual friend to them. And if they're doing that and they can do that for you, well, then you've really got something that will be deepening the process of going for refuge. So being careful with inputs, also being careful with the company that we keep. Sometimes we're distracted from our spiritual friends because there's another person there and we fixate on that person in the present and forget our spiritual friends, kind of who've gone into the background, as it were. So it does mean that we have to be careful who we're spending time with. And I mean that in the sense of if we're busy meeting lots and lots of people and we've got this great big social circle, well that's good in on one level, isn't it? But if we want spiritual friendship, which does require depth, then we do have to prioritise spending time with those people. Having a regularity of contact with our spiritual friends will facilitate that continuity, that sense of being able to be in relation to them through time. So the last point I've got here is cultivate that regularity of contact. We can do that in person, as I've just said, but we can also do that on an imaginal level. So put your spiritual friends in your metta bhavana. Do the metta bhavana every day and put your spiritual friends in it. You don't just have to bring to mind one friend in the metta bhavana. That's the beauty of the practice, isn't it? We have a stage on the good friend or the spiritual friend, but in the last stage we can bring in everybody. So bring in your spiritual friends into your daily meditation. It's bound to have an effect, isn't it? In terms of a sense of a continuity of your relationship with them, a fidelity to them, a faithfulness, a loyalty towards them. If you're bringing them to mind every day, then they will be there. So that's the far enemy then, distraction, forgetting, being distracted from our spiritual friends. The near enemy is attachment. So rather than forgetting our spiritual friends, be distracted from our fidelity to them, we attach to a particular version of them. We attach to our projection of them. So as Bhante said, we can have this tendency to see people as things. We see our spiritual friend as a thing, and then we fix that thing into our particular version of them. So a fixing, we might even place certain expectations on our spiritual friend. So this, it's fairly obvious, isn't it? This is the opposite of seeing them as growing, seeing them as evolving, seeing them as changing. It's a tendency to fix them in a particular shape or form. So in doing that, there's probably a kind of neurotic need that would underlie that kind of process. Some of this, as I've said already, I'm sure we're not doing it all the time. We're talking about the very subtle or quite subtle aspects of our own mind. So do bear that in mind, but it does need transforming. So there's probably a neurotic need underlying that, whether that's the desire for our friend's attention, the desire for our friend's affection, the desire for our friend's praise. Not that any of those things are wrong to receive them from a spiritual friend, but if we're eager for that, or trying to push for that, or trying to fix our friend as the person that will give us those things, well then we're into kind of the territory of attachment. Or do we expect our friend always to be available when we need them? You know, we might not be in contact with them for a while, we have a problem, we ask our spiritual friend to talk about it. Again, not a problem to resort to spiritual friends in time of difficulty. But what about when there's no difficulty? Are we still wanting to talk to our spiritual friend and be in relationship to them? So those are the kind of things that could go on, this distraction, this attachment, and that does create a barrier to deepening our spiritual friendships. But how do we know that that's happening? As I said, it can be quite subtle. On the surface, it might appear that everything is going great. Everything is good between us and our spiritual friend. We are seeing them as another person. We are relating to them on that basis. But how do we actually know? Sometimes certain crises or things can emerge that reveal the true nature of a friendship, don't they? But in his lecture on fidelity, Bhante does talk about some specific tests. So there are specific tests of fidelity, or in our case, to treat the subject more broadly, specific tests of spiritual friendship. So there are three. The first one is separation. So what happens to our relationship with our spiritual friend when we're not with them, when we're separated from them in some way? Whether that's they go away on retreat, or we don't see them for a while, or they move to another part of the country, they move to another country. When we're separated from them, what happens to the status of our spiritual friendship with them, our connection with them? Does it stay alive to us? Do we keep having contact in some form? Do we start speaking to them on the phone? Whatever it might be. Does it stay alive, or does it just fizzle out? Do we just forget them? Can we still relate to them on an imaginal level? And I imagine we've all faced this test in the last couple of years with the pandemic, not being able to meet with other people regularly in the same way that we used to. So maybe ask yourself that question: what happened to my spiritual friendships during the lockdown? And hopefully we took our connection onto an imaginal level, or we found ways to actually meet, like Zoom and the telephone and things like that, but also we cultivated more of an imaginal connection and sense of our friend. So even in their absence, we were with them. So that's one of the tests. The second test is death. So as Bhante says in the lecture on fidelity, the ultimate form of separation from somebody else is death. So it might be that we have or have had spiritual friends that have actually died and are not physically present anymore. But are we still, if you like, in relation to them? Do we still have a sense of fidelity, of faithfulness, loyalty to them, love for them? Do we honour that friendship even after death? In this life, if we have friends who are still alive, do we appreciate our friend's mortality? You know, if we're in touch with them as existing in time, well, there's going to be a time when death comes to our friends. Do we appreciate that mortality? Do we have an imaginative connection with our friend's impermanence? So you get those lines in the Dhammapada about those who are not, I'm afraid I can't quote it verbatim, those who do not realize that we're all heading to death will not compose their quarrels. Those who do realize we're all heading for death will compose their quarrels. And then the verse goes on to talk about love being the eternal law, not by hatreds or hatreds ever pacified here in the world. Hatreds are only pacified by love. This is the eternal law. I think that is verbatim, actually. At least Bhante's translation. I did it. So it might not be that we're quarrelling with our friends, but you know when we get those tensions that arise between us, well, if we were to imagine our friend's mortality, if we're in touch with that, our friend as not being immortal, our friend as impermanent, as our friend and ourselves heading for death, well, what would happen then to those disagreements, those tensions, those frictions that can arise? Would they be replaced by love, or would we find the love for them to address those things and to move beyond them? So we can see death then and the reality of death, the inevitability of death, as something by which we can gauge and test the depth of our friendships. So the third one, lastly, is isolation. So in his lecture, Bhante talks about this specifically with regard to fidelity to one's ideals. So are we able to maintain our ideals, have fidelity for our ideals, even when nobody else around us does? But that does relate to our connections with other people as well. So do we defend our spiritual friend when they're unfairly criticized? If we're in the company of other people and our spiritual friends are criticized, do we stand up and defend them? Do we speak out and voice their qualities? Do we speak out and point out where the criticism is unfair? Or do we hide? Do we slip back into the group and go along with what other people are saying about our friends? So challenging, I think, to do that. We're so kind of wired to fit in with the people around us that in the absence of our friend, we might not pass that test. So these three tests then, separation, death, isolation, they're markers of our degree of individuality. How much of a true individual are we? And they're also tests or markers of our fidelity and our capacity for friendship. And unless we're stream entrants, which is the traditional way of talking about true individuality and being a true individual, we will fail those tests. So I fail those three tests probably on a daily basis if I really looked at it and reflected. I don't pass those tests. When I'm separated from friends, I don't always maintain my fidelity to them. I don't have an awareness of their mortality, and when they're not present, there are times when I let criticisms go unchallenged. So I can confess to you all that I personally fail those tests sometimes. But like I said before, we don't have to feel too bad about that, because we can do something about it. So let's come back to the aphorism that we've started this exploration of individuality and fidelity with. So only individuals can practice true friendliness. Only individuals can practice true friendliness. So the way in which we can begin to pass those tests more and more fully, the way in which we can develop our capacity for spiritual friendship, develop our imaginative empathy and identification with friends, is to make sure that we are working on our individuality. Make sure that we're working on ourselves. So it might seem counterintuitive. We're here to talk about friendship. We're here to talk about what we do with other people. But actually, one of the things we really need to do is look at ourselves. Look at ourselves, develop our individuality, work on our distractions, work on our attachments. So of course, that's the whole area of cultivating integration, cultivating positive emotion, moving from attachment, from prema to metta, etc. But I think we can go further than that even. So to put it poetically, we need to enter the cave. We need to enter the tiger's cave. Sometimes we get that metaphor in Buddhism, don't we? The tiger's cave, where the footprints go in and no footprints come out. So we need to enter the cave, if you like, of spiritual death. So the way to really become an individual and to really be a spiritual friend is to go through the process of spiritual death and spiritual rebirth, to go beyond our limited selves. So I'm just going to go back to Bhante's memoirs and back to the Virupaksha Guha, back to the cave. And just before what I read before, where he has the vision of Amitabha, he gives a description of what was happening on a kind of daily basis to him and for him in the cave. So have a listen to this. We'll talk about working on oneself. Long before dawn, as well as at intervals throughout the day and night, we heard the temple bell. Perhaps it was my imagination, but I seemed always to hear the temple bell. It was not really one bell, but two bells that I heard, the first being higher in pitch than the second, but the twin strokes came so close together and were at once so well contrasted and so well harmonized that they constituted for me a single experience. As a single experience, I referred them to a single origin and thought of the sound as being produced by one bell, or rather by a kind of double bell, which was struck perhaps either by two hammers in one place or two places by one hammer. The bell sounded louder than any of the instruments that accompanied the evening worship, louder than all of them combined. It was so loud that it penetrated rock as easily as air. So loud that it made no difference whether we were inside the cave or outside it. When we were inside the cave, indeed, it was as though the great bell swung not somewhere inside the temple, but up in the air directly outside the cave. Sometimes I heard it in my dreams. Hour after hour it seemed to toll, incessant and insistent, wave after wave of brazen sound breaking upon me like the repeated thunder of surf on the seashore. Sometimes it was though the bell, swinging outside, was striking against the hill, and that the hill was the bell, and the bell itself the hammer that struck the bell. Again, the hill was not bell, but anvil, and the bell the hammer that stroke after sonorous stroke smote upon the anvil. The point of impact, the point where the hill and bell met, where hammer smote anvil, was the cave, was me. between the hill and the bell, between the anvil and the hammer, I was being reshaped, was being beaten into something. I knew not what. I was being changed. So when I say we need to enter the cave and really work on ourselves and go through that process of spiritual death and spiritual rebirth, it's in that nature that I had in mind, really being hammered, being reshaped, being turned into something. So another image, just playing on the metaphor of the cave, I quite like it as a metaphor for spiritual life. We've also got the metaphor of Plato's cave, which those of you who've dipped into some Western philosophy are probably familiar with. So Plato describes the human existential situation as like being at the back of a cave, with your back to the entrance and facing forwards into the rock surface at the back of the cave. And we can't turn round and see the reality behind us. All we can see is the shadows of what's happening, appearing on the rock in front of our faces. And we can't turn round because we're chained. So we're chained in position in a cave, staring at this cave wall, seeing only the shadows and reflections of the reality that's going on behind our backs, so to speak. So that's Plato's metaphor for the human existential situation. And we get a similar metaphor in Buddhism, don't we, with the fetters. So the chains, the things that bind us. Buddhism's good at enumerating what they actually are. And in particular, we have the first three fetters, the breaking of which is said to constitute stream entry, or the becoming of a true individual, to use that language. So if we really want to be individuals, if we really want to be capable of true friendliness, if we really want to be true spiritual friends, then we need to become stream entrants. We need to break those fetters. We need to break out of that cave and really see the reality that is outside of us. So very briefly, because this is going to be familiar ground for all of you, the first three fetters are Sakkaya Drishti, fixed self-view, Sila Vrata Paramarsha, the observance of rites and rituals as ends in themselves. Elsewhere, Bhante describes that as going through the motions. I quite like that, going through the motions. And thirdly, Visikicca, which is doubt, or vagueness. I think Bhante calls it vagueness in one of his lectures. So fixed self-view, going through the motions, and doubt or vagueness. Let's put it like that. And it's easy to see how those three things, those three fetters, fetter our spiritual friendships, restrict and limit our spiritual friendships. So if we've got a tendency to fix ourselves, we've got a tendency to fix other people. If we go through the motions in our lives, in our spiritual lives, if we just do practices for the sake of doing them, without having a whole heart, being half-hearted in them, well, we'll do that in our friendships. We'll carry that attitude into our friendships. We might meet up with our spiritual friends regularly, but we're not really there. It's half-hearted. And doubt and vagueness, well, if we lack integrity, if we don't really know what we're about, if we haven't decided what we're about, it's going to be hard for a friend to get to know us because we don't know ourselves. And it's going to be hard for us to get to know them because which bit of us is getting to know them. So we can see how the three fetters fetter and bind and shackle and limit our capacity for spiritual friendship. So lastly then, well, what's the alternative to that? How do we break free of those three things in particular? I'll give you Bhante's list of the three C's. Easy to remember, three C's. Creativity, commitment, and clarity. So there are three things that we need to become a true individual, to be a true spiritual friend. So first of all, creativity, and we've talked about this already. This is seeing our lives as a creative process, seeing that nothing about us is fixed, actually. Everything is changing, everything can be changed. And that's true in other people. So it's relating to people as growing, living, evolving beings, like lotuses. So seeing creatively. Secondly, with commitment, are we doing spiritual practices wholeheartedly? Particularly with our spiritual friendships, are we wholehearted about our spiritual friendships? It might be that you don't have very much time. I know some of you are fathers, some of you work long hours. It might be that you don't have a lot of time for additional meditation, for meeting spiritual friends. But when you do, are you doing it wholeheartedly? Are you free of that second fetter of sila vrata paramarsha? And lastly, clarity. Well, make up your mind. Make up your mind about things. Don't prolong doubts that you've got indefinitely, particularly doubts about spiritual life and about practice and about the order as the context for your practice. If you can be really clear about that, if you can clear up those doubts, then you'll be clear what you stand for, your friend will be clear what you stand for, and the way to deeper friendship will lie open for you. Okay, so if we do that work, if we focus on those areas in particular, but more broadly as well, just that whole process of transformation, of self-transformation, well then a vision can open up. So Bhante has been hammered in the cave, as he put it, been smote on the anvil by the hammer in the cave, but then Amitabha appears to him. So a vision opens up, if you like, the yidam can appear before us, the Dharma can be really available to us and appear to us and before us. We'll become like the yidam, like I said before, we become like the Buddha or Bodhisattva, and it's the Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas that really are individuals in the truest and fullest sense, the highest sense, they're embodiments of that, and for that reason they have fidelity, faithfulness, loyalty in the highest possible sense. They're spiritual friends in the highest possible sense, even outside of space and time. And we can develop those qualities, we can be raised up to that level, to those qualities, by doing that work on ourselves in relation to others who are doing it themselves as well. So that's it for today, and tomorrow we'll move on to the Dakini refuge and see more themes in spiritual friendship.